Welcome to the first of a new sub-series underneath the Rudimental Podcast. I am Josh Hartwell.
And I'm Cameron Leach.
And we decided to get together and do this sub-series based on a lot of things, and mostly that we are able to communicate very clearly with each other and have a really nice time talking and have good conversation. And it can get a little unfiltered, I think, Cam. I think. Would you agree?
I'll just apologize, actually.
we kind of tee each other up. I think it's good. And so we're going to do this, I think, once a month, maybe twice a month, depending on how we feel. And I think a lot of people will enjoy this. I got a lot of good feedback on the episode I did with Cam before this was even a thought a few months ago. And I had a great time. We're recording this after the fact. I don't know how you felt, but I had a great time.
Yeah, it was a good conversation, and I hope everybody enjoys it.
Yeah. So without further ado, here is the first of the Offstage series with Cameron Leach.
That's cool.
And then I had a really old CB drum set that's like missing a bunch of tension rods and lugs, and it's missing, I think it's missing one of the bass drum hoops.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it? I was like, what? I totally forget I had this stuff. So, it's gonna be a lot of around the house stuff today. That's pretty much it. And then. What about you? What do you got going?
I'm doing a master class tonight, but it's one of these things. I was like, hey, what do you guys want me to do for this? You know, because with all this COVID stuff, I've been asking people ahead of time. A lot of times they're like, hey, just do whatever you want. And I'm like, no, you should probably tell me what to do because,
yeah,
like, I don't know what the state of affairs is at your university, but this is a place local here in Columbus. And the guy was like, yeah, man, I don't think you should play. Can you just... We're just gonna have like a therapy session about like your life over COVID and I don't know how he put it exactly, like talk about the challenges and how you've kept your career up. And I'm like, I'm just gonna talk about whiskey, you know, because like that's all I've done.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it'll be interesting. But it was actually relieving to hear like, hey, we don't want you to play. It's like I don't have to set all the mics up, you know.
Oh yeah, dude. Yeah. Well, so you're not going in person then?
No, and actually we probably could have, but.
Yeah, so I imagine so, right? Since it's in town.
Yeah, I don't know it seems like every school's doing something different at this point. But like all my buddies that are teaching public schools, they're pretty much after their spring break, they're fully back 5 days a week. Yep. So I don't know.
Texas has been back the whole year.
It's a wild west, man.
Yeah, dude. We're out here just yeehaw. But that is cool though that, because like we've had a few of those master classes when I was in school.
Mm-hmm.
I think when Clocks in Motion came in, I think one of the best master classes I've ever had, because they were just sitting there talking about how they do things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that is just as much of a master class in itself, I think.
Yeah.
Because they do the percussion ensemble thing well. They do it really well. They handle it well, and they I was asking more questions about the business side than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And and it doesn't have to be playing every time, I don't think, which is sometimes a misconception, because you'll get dudes who come in and they're like, this is how you practice.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, okay, well, sweet. I mean, for the grads, it's not very.
Yeah.
You know, for the grads, it wasn't very helpful, but, you know, for the younger dudes, I'm sure. But it's, well, at least you don't have to set all the stuff up, like you said. So
yeah.
That's even better.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
You're just going to sit right there, huh?
I don't know. I thought maybe I should at least appear next to an instrument. Like, look like I'm still a percussionist. So I might set up a little rig in the basement.
You got sticks on the wall.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess you're, counts, this, right? This works. I mean, I have this
one
drum.
Missing a bead, and then you have a drum. Yep. Okay.
There we go. So, I mean, I don't know, man. It's like a lot of these master classes online are so weird too, because all the students mute themselves, and then you just are talking to nobody. And I just tell the professor, like, please banter with me. Don't let me just.
Yep.
I don't want to lecture for an hour. I'm a good talker only when people tee me up. Like, I can't just actually talk.
Just pull it. Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm just like, pull it out of my ass. Like,
that's why.
Talk about tuning, I guess.
That's why with you, it's easy to go back and forth, but I can't do solo podcasts. It's just not.
No.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing, too. Like, I didn't realize how difficult it is to drive a conversation when the other person's not that great at speaking. Not talking about anybody specifically, but like, you know, some episodes have been like, okay, I gotta drive this one more, and then like there's ones like ours that it just kind of drives itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like a Tesla. So it's really easy. So it with some people. But I get it. I mean, like, some people are also like, I've had people tell me no to come on because they're just not that great at conversation, which is totally understandable.
Yeah.
Despite how much something like this could help, you know, get somebody's name out or whatever, at least they're being honest with the fact that, you know, it's like, hey, I'm just not, I don't want to talk, like, I'm not good at it. So it's like, okay,
I dig that. I wish some people would have told me that when I was podcasting. I tell you, man. Yeah, I don't know. I don't miss it. It's more fun for me to be on this end of things, and it's like, it's your thing, and I can just come in, and it's so much better that way for me than trying to, like, yeah, because you got to study your guests and read their stuff and watch their videos.
Yep.
And then if they don't have anything that they really want to say, it's like, well, all right, you know.
Yeah, it's I try to avoid now. I used to be bad at this, but I used to, you know, be like, so how'd you get started?
It,
you
know, like, yeah.
Did you play drums as a kid? Like, you know, and it's like, yes, obviously, moron. And one guest was like, you know, I'm really glad that we didn't go down this route of like how I got started or anything like that. I was like, jeez, I was about to do that. I'm really glad I didn't.
That's so funny. That's funny, man.
It's classic formula. Like, it's too easy of a formula, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think there's enough of that going on where it's like, because like you listen to somebody like Rogan or anybody like that, Adam Carolla, and all those guys were there just talk, and like sometimes it's not until the very end of a 3.5 hour conversation where they're like, oh yeah, by the way, what do you want to plug?
Right.
And they're like, oh, I have a new stand-up special out or something like
that. Yeah, no, that's the best way to have these conversations, man. It's funny, we just go. We don't even say like, hey, we're going. We just start talking.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing too is like when people start talking, I was always like, save it, don't stop it. I'm gonna hit. Yeah, let me hit record. Yeah.
Dude, there's been so many times where I forget to hit record.
Yeah.
And like there's been gyms, you know. It was actually Casey who told me, he's like, dude, just hit record as soon as you start, because like there's sometimes some great gyms before the actual episode starts. So I've been doing that ever since. And he was right. I was like, all right, well,
yeah,
gonna keep doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, for those listening right now, we already tried this episode once.
Yeah, this is strike two.
And I went down a dark path on that episode. We cut that shit out. It is done.
Immediately.
I said, we're doing this again.
You know, it takes practice. for these kind of things, right? I mean, if we're going to start this series off right, we don't really want to start it off that way.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't great.
That was, yeah, you know, I thought about that, and I was like, you know, maybe I could have steered it away from that, but I was also enjoying it. So,
dude, if you would have tried, I would have kept going. I would have just steamrolled it because I was in it.
You were like, yeah. But what I was saying was,
but yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I mean, I think one thing that I'm really excited about this series is that we're able to have some conversations that will naturally come about, that I think we align very, I told you this off camera, but for everybody listening, we align a lot on a lot of things. And we also, it seems like it's very easy to talk to each other when it comes to Cam and I. So it's like, might as well make a podcast series out of it, because, and another thing too is, like, he's not doing his podcast anymore, but this gives him a chance to do some podcasting. Mm-hmm. We'll probably do this, I don't know, once a month, twice a month, maybe, mm-hmm. you know? So just something that, it's a lot of fun and it's easy for us. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Might as well, is what I say.
What's nice about it too is, knock on wood, we probably don't need many edits in these, you know? We don't really have any dead time, so... That was always my thought. If I ever did bring the podcast back, there's no way that I'm going to edit anything. Like, editing Drums and Drams is enough. And I've already gone to the point where I'm saying to myself, like, of the videos I put out, I'm only going to edit them once a week. The other ones I'm giving some title called, like, Quick Sips. That way there's, like, this expectation that I'm just cranking them out. And,
right.
Like, you're going to watch me rinse that shit around in my mouth and like sit and ponder it for a second.
Yeah.
You know, and usually I cut that out because it's pretty weird and you can hear like the rinsing sounds. I'm like, you're gonna get all of it.
Ooh, you know what I mean? ASMR. It's gonna become an ASMR channel and he's gonna be like in the mic.
Yeah, man. So
that's been going really well for you though.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I don't know if it'll make it in the beginning of this, but I just dropped the Patreon today, and so we're recording this on, is this the 31st? Does March have?
It is 31st of March.
March has 31 days. I always have to say that little rhyme in my head, or that little song, you know? Anyways.
Oh, dude, I'd never learned. I missed school that day. So it took me, I was like, thank God for iPhones, because I never learned that. I'm like, sitting there, I'm like, all right, well, maybe, all right, tomorrow's the last day of March, it's March 29th, and I'm like, nope, it's not. Okay,
yeah.
April has 30 days, not March. Anyway, sorry.
No, you're good. So we're recording this on the 31st. Tomorrow's a Thursday night, which is when I do my Drums and Drams live stream. So I'm going to announce the Patreon on there, do a bunch of giveaways. I just got monetized
there you go.
Today, basically. So I got to put the application in, and it'll take a few weeks. But yeah, man, I'm excited about it. And hopefully start making a little bit of money on the side, you know.
Have you noticed, like, I know it's called Drums and Drams, but, like, is it attracting more drummers who like whiskey, or is it everybody? You know what I mean?
Surprisingly, almost no drummers.
the drums part of it caters towards what you do, but like I assume that whiskey attracts all walks of life. So
yeah, it's not really like when I started the channel, I thought because I've got an established following on the drum side of things that I would like try to kind of promote that a little bit, like use that as a gateway to get people in, and it didn't work. Yeah. I mean, it got a couple of people on my early live streams, and I brought Josh Quillen on to do this like live tasting, and it was cool to hang with Josh and do it, but like, with the actual whiskey community, none of that resonated.
Of course, yeah.
And then I started realizing, like, well, you know, you get like 100 subs, and that's probably like your friends and family and a couple whiskey people that have stumbled upon you. But you get to 500, 600, 700. Not that that's a lot, but you start going like, okay, let me look at who these are, and none of them are musicians. You're like, well, I guess I'm a whiskey person now. You know, like, it's kind of weird. So the drums thing, you're right. The name is literally just for me. I like alliterations a lot. So I had Project Percussion, which will never exist now, PP, and then I had DD, Drums and Drams. Like, I just love that vibe, you know?
First of all, shout out Grant Furness, because he did that logo, and he did my logo.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at you have 1,000 subs now.
I got 1,000. Yeah, yesterday, I think over the last, well, since I talked to you yesterday, I got like 40 more, which is cool.
You got 40 more yesterday?
Yeah, I've been having these days where I'll get 80, 40, 60 in a day, which is pretty crazy.
Your Elijah Craig A121 barrel proof is your most watched.
Probably some like 3,500 or something maybe.
Yeah, 3,300, yeah.
Yeah, so what's funny is like, do you watch any Gary Vee stuff?
Every once in a while, yeah.
Yeah.
I like some of his stuff.
Like, he talks a lot about just like frequency and speed of content, mm-hmm. you know, and in the music world, you just can't, with classical, you can't learn a marimba piece every day. So you can put out practice clips, but to put out full content, it's tough. Like, if I really wanted to, I could make at least one video a day. You know what I mean? And so, like, this next phase of Drums and Drams is going to be really frequent. But the reason I bring that up is because that Elijah Craig video, all the top uploads, I have like a category on my page of top uploads. They are all limited releases. And I got those videos out before anybody else. So
I overpaid
for them and had them shipped here. And that cost was made up in views and subscribers, which will pay off later. So, like, the speed mattered. You know, I sat down, I had one day to get to know the whiskey and then put that review up.
Well, there's a certain investment aspect to content creation, right? I mean,
yeah.
That you were hoping pays off later. I find that with a lot of Twitch streamers where they're like, I'm going to make all these upgrades to my computer, my webcam, my mic, all, you know, like, in hopes that there's a little bit more live entertainment aspect to that, but
yeah,
that certain, like, okay, like, for instance, if I wanted to, you know, for this, if I wanted to build a studio and, like, you know, have a backdrop and make it a high quality, I really feel like that in itself attracts more people, because mm-hmm. as great as these remote calls are, I think one thing that attracts people to those comedy podcasts and everything like that is the set, and
yeah,
they're there in person. There's a different feel to that I think more people enjoy. So it's there's a certain, when it comes to that, especially because whiskey's not cheap, right? I mean, at all. Especially when you have to taste the upper tier stuff too. It's like, you could probably do a budget whiskey. I'm sure you have done a budget whiskey video or something. Like, I've seen plenty of those where they're like, here are your my top five favorite, you know, like Elijah Craig, Four Roses, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, but then I really think the real whiskey heads are the ones who are not afraid to drop hundreds of dollars on a bottle, and like, they want to know what it is first before they make that purchase, you know?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different kinds of content, which is what I'm learning. And I was talking to some other, we call ourselves whiskey tubers, right? There's like a pretty tight-knit community of reviewers, for instance. I'd say in that community, really closely, there's probably 15 to 20 of us that, like, we jump on each other's live streams and we're just doing all sorts of stuff. But then there's like all the followers and fans of those channels that really intermingle. So, like, between those followers and fans, you're trying to appeal to people who know you and your style. Then you're trying to appeal to people who will never buy a bottle over $30. Then you're going to appeal to like the aficionados who are drinking the expensive stuff, and you want to basically show them that, you know, you can take them from beginning to end of that whiskey and like guide them through the whole thing and earn their trust. And then there's the people who don't give a shit about whiskey, who just see springtime whiskeys, 2021, bright colors, and they click it, you know, discovery content. Yeah. So like, it's so weird because I have people saying, dude, you're putting out too many videos. Like, my subscribers are getting pissed because they're getting so many notifications. I just did one every day this week. And they're like, why are you doing this? And it's like, it ain't for you. You know, it's for, like, this week is about my Patreons coming out. So I'm bleeding the feed and just trying to like bring people in so I can get that early Patreon adoption. And So strategizing is weird, but it's you can't do that stuff in contemporary music because there's not a wide audience for it. And we're going to kid ourselves if we think that we're going to be bringing in a bunch of people. The only people have hacked it a little bit, but the actual dividends it's paid beyond YouTube views is small. Like Christoph Seitzin did The Attraction by Emmanuel Cezanne.
Yeah.
The short clip. It's got millions of views. But like that dude was already playing big gigs, and it's not like that boosted him to Yo-Yo Ma status. It's just like, it's great that he's got a lot of views, but it's not going to earn him money. He's not running a Patreon or monetizing it or whatever, you know? So it's just different.
Yeah, 7.2 million views on that.
Holy shit.
3 years ago.
Oh, that's hilarious.
The short version.
It's like 2 minutes. Well, that's why it works, you know?
2 minutes, 47 seconds. Because like if you get people dialed in, so like for instance there's another the most popular full version 10 minutes 22 seconds 4,600
there you go,
which is very dude, there's become it's become like a science to this stuff, man.
He's got a thousand he has like 1,500 times the amount of views.
Yeah,
that's wild. Yeah,
yeah. And I don't a lot of it has to do with how it's shot.
Mm.
Like I find that the videos that get people outside of the activity of the craft are the ones who like how it's like shot like a movie.
Yeah.
Or, you know, very theatrical in a sense of like, so like Alex Stopa's video of that he did of Sequoia, his marimba duet, is shot like that. Or parts of it is, and then he does like a multi, it's a lot of cool editing, and that is one of his best videos because of, or best performing videos because of everybody coming to watch it that is not even associated with percussion.
Yeah.
So 15,000 views on YouTube, and I think even more on the Tap Space YouTube, but yeah, that is... Yeah.
And you're always balancing too. Like I was saying, you don't want to make your main fans or subscribers upset. But like in the percussion space, if you make a video that's like too cinematic or too clickbaity, people get pissed. You know, they like they get angry at you, and because you're denigrating the craft, or you know, whatever, I don't know, devaluing the craft or whatever. And it's like, no, man, like, this is smart. We actually need more clickbait in this in our space to kind of get it recognized. And if we're not willing to do that, if we want to shun people that do that, that's kind of hilarious.
That kind of leads me into my rant from yesterday that the world will never
hear. Hey man, reprise your rant. I'm just not going to reprise mine.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, I just think we take too long. I think we take forever.
Yeah.
To catch up, and a lot of it has to do with the older generation. A lot of it has to do with we have a lot of facets within, like for me, if you want to talk about the marching facet, they figured it out. At least they're on the right track. I mean, at least there's companies that are dedicated to content creation for that. You talk about Gridbook, right?
Yeah.
Whether you agree with Gridbook stuff or not, and you like their stuff or not, they're making cool stuff that's attracting people to the activity.
Yeah.
Right. You look at what everybody did with WGI this year, what they had to do because it was a virtual season, right? They're making movies and really well shot and edited videos, like, and it's very interesting because it changes the landscape forever within that activity. Look, I have said before, like, I don't have as much experience in WGI as I do outdoor, but I will say that if you want to talk about an activity that attracts more people to it, like, you're going to get indoor attracting people to marching percussion more than outdoor, because outdoor is more brass.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to have what gets people to go to drum corps shows that have nothing to do with music is more than likely the combination of both the winds and the percussion.
Yeah.
Indoor, you're getting people to marching percussion based on it's just that, and the visual aspect, the stories behind the shows and everything like that. So if you combine that with the quality of content they're coming out with, you're then attracting even more people. So I feel like anybody who hates on the fact that somebody wants to make a dope ass video of a marimba solo, whereas like just setting up your iPhone and a couple condenser mics and putting it on YouTube, that's good for like maybe people who want to play the piece and look at your interpretation, right? But I think if we want to grow this thing and make quality stuff, I don't think there should be any problem with, look, I want to make a video like that.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think it's cool. And there's not, I mean, to be honest with you, it's the way we should go, right? I mean, if you look at standard YouTube, like, product review videos or even, like, like, I'm going to review this North Face backpack and it's got, like, B-roll and it's, like, dope and everything. And you're like, man, this is really well shot. And so, I don't know. I just think we take too long.
Yeah.
I really do. Even marching has got it figured out. Drum set, if you want to put it under our umbrella, has figured it out. You know, the White Pines video?
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Kyle a little bit about that. That's a cool video.
Yeah.
It really is. And I see no problem with content coming out like that. And if we take this long to do anything, which we have in the past, we're in big trouble because we're gonna miss the cart every time.
Yeah,
we're just gonna be waving from behind. Like, it's so I'm trying to I don't know what I can really do except for just rant about it and ponder it. But
for the diehards, I should know how to say her last name, Adelaide Ferrier, or you know, the French percussion artist. She's just mm-hmm. absolutely incredible. For me, like, as someone who does that, or even just a diehard fan who understands kind of this stuff, her videos are shot in like plane hangars and in front of like chateaus and like nice estates and stuff. And clearly, yeah, they're music videos, you know? Clearly, she's just, I mean, there's not even microphones in the shot. So, like, you know that this is not legit. But, and I used to get upset about that. I was like, come on, as a purist or whatever. And then you realize, like, well, for me, it's smart. It's smart. You realize, okay, she's being really smart about this. She's trying to reach a bigger audience. But when you actually see her play live, you know, it's like a drummer on an album. If you see them play live and they suck, like, you're an asshole, you know, because you programmed your drums in the studio. But like, seeing her live videos, I was like, oh man, she can do this. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so then
she ripped.
You like earn the right, in my mind, that's like covering all your bases. You earn the right to put out a video like that if you can actually play that way live. But that's just one example where I remember in grad school, I'd be like, what is this? You know?
Yeah.
And then you see a video of her playing like Bach or playing like some crazy transcription live, and you're like, okay, she didn't miss a note.
At all.
Like, yeah.
Some people, I guess, earn that. And I think, too, it's... There's probably some people who don't want to grow the community that much. There's probably people who are, because like we talked about this mm-hmm. in our never going to be released episode of like, there's people who are very protective and they're sensitive about their gigs and, you know, like making sure they don't want to lose them because there's not a ton of them. I get that. But, you know, how do you get asses in seats? It's, you got to make stuff that's accessible to everyone, mm-hmm. not just, here I am presenting this music and you don't even know how to pronounce the name of it, but, and it's also, oh, by the way, it's French Impressionist. You know what that means? And everybody's like, no, we don't know what that means. Like, except for the classical community. So.
Like, you're talking about, what were we talking about? Like, oh, the people who don't want it to grow. Right. So, mm-hmm. so, I mean, those are the people that are making their money not playing, you know, like, whether that's being a college professor or some people who are like in the new music communities, but like work other jobs and then like get to do new music on the side. They might have 3 music degrees and they're making a couple $1,000s a year from actually doing music and making money elsewhere. That's not a problem, but those people aren't going to be invested in putting butts in seats, like you're saying, because I don't want to call what they're doing cushy, because it's not cushy, but, you know, pressure makes diamonds, right? Is that kind of, that's how you make diamonds, right? Pressure? What am I thinking of? I'm thinking of diamonds, right?
Yeah, you're thinking of, yeah.
Or is it pearls? No, it's clams. I'm thinking diamonds. Yeah.
No, it's diamonds.
I'm thinking
because,
diamonds.
Because, yeah, diamonds are, they're way down.
Yeah, there, that's it. Know? So anyways, that was...
Welcome to my geography podcast. This is with...
anyways.
No, wait, geology.
It's geology, yeah.
Oh, dude.
Man. I know, this was brutal.
I have a master's degree.
Let's just move on. No,
yeah.
But we, you know, you need the people who want to expand the things are the people who rely on it monetarily. So we need more people like that. I don't want to say we need more floundering musicians, but we kind of do for that reason. Yeah. Those are the people that push the art form forward realistically. The people who push it forward theoretically are in the four walls of the colleges and universities. And that's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'll go on and on about that if you let me, so I'm going to cut that off.
Well, I'll say one more thing, is that another theme from yesterday that this is a different context, but I think mistakes can be made when it comes to new music and even old music. Like, in our art form, maybe not... The problem I have is, like, everybody assumes that just because it's new, it's good, right? Just because it's a new combination of instruments, marimba and barry sax or something like that, you know, we're trying. Nobody should automatically be like, it's good. I think there should be, new music concerts should have a presumption that it is going to, this is new and it's up for debate at this point.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't know if I'm making sense or not.
No, I guess I guess you are. I mean,
yeah,
I don't,
there's good is subjective anyway, but it's one of those things of, like, I think boundaries, in order to push boundaries, mistakes need to be made in general. Mm-hmm. So it's like, and also, there shouldn't be any kind of harsh backlash against it anyway. It should be constructive, you know. So,
I mean, some things are going to be important but still never get played. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot... so many of my friends can cite all these, like, new composers from all over the world. And I'm, you know, theorist friends. And I'm like, I don't know any of this. You know. But, like, John Luther Adams stuff, it's, like, super important. But it's still not like a lucrative, it's not like money making to go play a Nuxuit or something. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're going to get grant money to fund a performance like that. Some of these seminal works, I mean, the Mathematics of Resonant Bodies is incredible, but, like, to actually do that piece and to tour it around, maybe that was a little more feasible. But just all those, like, big pieces that are important, but they're still not helping in a, maybe a financial way or, like, a viability way for our industry. So I don't know.
Yeah. It's a weird subject.
Cause it'll probably be in, like, a textbook one day, but yeah, you know what I mean?
I mean, textbooks that I never read. And so, like, it's, and clearly I don't even know the difference between geography and geology, but, yeah, you know, I mean, this is definitely a rabbit hole we go down, so I to avoid what happened yesterday.
Get out of abort, get out of here.
Well, speaking of music, you just finished a percussion concerto premiere. So why don't you talk about how that went, because you were under a rock for like 3 months, so it's all good.
Yeah. Well, the story of the piece, we'll kind of start there. I mean, the story of the piece is that basically 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, I had, 2.5 years ago, I had moved home from Eastman, you know, and plugged myself back into the community in Columbus. And there's a family here called the Johnstone Fund for New Music, Jack and Zoe Johnstone. And they have this organization, and they have a lot of money to kind of give out for the arts. Specifically, new music is really what they support here. And I had done something on one of their series before. And we had kind of forged a close relationship. And I went out to dinner with them after one of the shows on one of their series with, I think, Hub New Music was the artist on that series. And they're a great group. And I was at dinner with them. And I said, you know, I'd love to get a percussion concerto and blah, blah, blah. And so they ended up telling me, like, I was working at Kent State at the time. And they're like, go talk to Adam Roberts, which is this guy that I was working with. He was a composition professor up there, still is. So I went to coffee with him, and I like did my little pitch. Like, I just got to know him, and then I was like, hey, would you write a percussion concerto? Like, would you be interested? Because his music was kind of, I listened to some of it on SoundCloud. It was pretty cool, pretty out there in some ways, like not, but not, it was still accessible from an audience perspective. So he was like, yeah, I mean, if you find the money in the orchestra, and like that was it. So then I went to the Johnstos. I was like, hey, Adam said yes, like, you know, but he needs X amount of money. And it was not a small amount of money. Oh, you know what I mean? And they were like, okay, we'll do it. And I was like, oh, okay. And they're like, yeah, just, we need to find an orchestra. So go talk to the New Albany Symphony. You know, we know Heather, the director, and then Luis, the conductor. It's like, all right. And they both play in the Columbus Symphony with me. So backstage at a concert, I say, hey, Heather, you know, I got this idea about, she's like, yep, we'll do it. That's fine. Go ask Luis. And he's the principal cellist of the orchestra, conductor of this other group. I go up to him and he's like, yeah, sounds great.
Let's take a quick second to pause the episode to talk about how you can support the podcast even further. Thank you for listening for one thing, but another thing is how you can support is a monthly subscription to the podcast. It's just 99 cents a month. It goes directly to me, and I can use that money to buy more equipment, video equipment, recording equipment, and it goes directly back into the podcast. So if you could click that support link in the description below, I would greatly appreciate it. Back to the episode.
So like literally like I had the money in one conversation, and then 10 minutes backstage at a concert, I got the approval from the orchestra, and that was it. So you know, fast forward 2 years later, which and he finished the piece basically. He wrote it during the pandemic over the summer, gave it to me in December and January, and we workshopped a lot of it and changed some things. Mm-hmm. And like I learned it in 2 weeks because I procrastinated it. Yeah, and then the performance was good, man. I mean, it was a hard piece for this orchestra, I'll tell you that. Like, it was right at the edge of their ability level, but they bring in performers from the Columbus Symphony to kind of fill out the group right up at the end of the rehearsal run into the performances. So they kind of bolster the sound and the timing and stuff. And so it all came together. It was very weird to be back on stage, I'll tell you what.
Well, it kind of reignited some stuff for you though, right? I mean, I think you mentioned that in a post or something like that you were like, it felt good overall, right? It felt good to be back out there and to be playing something like that.
Yeah. I mean, what happened for me was I just like separated myself from music during the pandemic to kind of cope with it. Cause the first couple months I was doing virtual stuff, and I just remember just saying, fuck this. You know, I was upset, and I felt just like crushed because the momentum of my career was so, it was just on this crazy exponential curve. I mean, I was in my mind, it felt like I was about to get that management deal. I was about to get these extra concertos and these legit recital series. I had everything planned out, and it all came crumbling down. I think anybody in a transitional period of their life or on the cusp of something or precipice, whatever you want to say, whatever industry, or even going from high school to college, any of these transitional moments, all of that was ruined by the pandemic. Yep. And I think the fallout of that is hard to deal with, and I still don't know how to deal with it, but it reignited it in me. And getting back on stage, I didn't really feel any emotions. This was kind of in my long post that I made about it. Like, I didn't feel any emotion. I was rehearsing and I was like, oh man, usually when I rehearse a concerto with an orchestra, I'm like pretty scared, you know, because that's like a lot of pressure. And you have great musicians in the orchestra looking at you and judging you as the soloist.
Right.
And by the performance, like all of it kind of came back. And I got really, really nervous and emotional before the performance. And I ran back down to my dressing room. I was like standing off stage during the first piece. And I ran back down to my dressing room and I just looked in the mirror. And I used to do this, but it was different this time. Like I self-talked to myself in the mirror. And you say ridiculous shit, you know, you fucking got this, man. You got this, you know, and you're like talking to yourself. It's almost like you're drunk, you know, when you talk to yourself in the mirror and you're drunk at a house party. But I'm like, you worked your ass off for this for this many years and blah, blah, blah. And it's true. Like, it made me finally take a step back and look at everything I've done to this point. Only being out of school for 2 years until the pandemic happened. And having played like, I don't know, what is it, like 40 or 50 recitals, all these Premier 3 concertos, all this stuff. I was like, you know what, I actually have worked my ass off. And it felt like I hadn't done anything when the pandemic hit. Felt like I had nothing else in the music career to do or nothing to not live for, but, you know, to strive for. And now I'm like, no, fuck that. Like, I worked for this. And and the pandemic's not going to take that away. And you know, I've dealt with a couple of shitty people in the industry throughout the pandemic, which that I won't get into that. But it's like those people aren't going to take it away either by attacking me, personally attacking me about stupid shit, you know, like, no.
They think they can. And it we can get into that. But no, we can't actually. But, you know, they think they can. But ultimately, it's about this kind of warrior spirit within an art form. I used to think of it that way.
Yeah.
Especially since I played sports as a kid, and like there's a healthy competition and unhealthy competition, I guess, that presents itself within everything. And there's also a competition within yourself. And Dean always talked about self one versus self two. So when Dean was touring his marimba stuff in the 90s, he would often be off stage like you were, hey, off stage. And he would be like, he would talk about self one versus self two. And like self one is the one that's like, we're going to do this. We're going to stay calm, relaxed. All the preparation's done. All we got to do is just play the gig. And then self two is sitting there like, F you, you're terrible. You don't deserve this. You know, imposter syndrome. You know, these musicians are all counting on you. You know, it's everything negative, right? And he used to go in a dressing room and, similar to what you did, and just kind of yell at himself about try to fight self two with self one.
Yeah.
And that's it's an oddly powerful thing, I think, when it comes to, especially when it's a high pressure situation like a concerto, right? I mean, that's, you almost have to do that, I think. You know, if you don't, you're either a robot or an alien. So
to me, it's like living, I can't really live any other way. You know, I found that during the pandemic. Do I think this is going to sound ridiculous? Like, do I think that in 2 years I could make a living in the spirits industry and like literally being a YouTuber, maybe exclusively, or maybe going and doing half YouTube? Yeah, I think I could. But like, I don't get the rush, the roller coaster rush, and I have to have that. And it's like a drug, you know, and I didn't realize how much I lived for that until I got back on stage. And you're just like, holy shit, man, this is, people, you know, it's easy to, it might sound silly what I'm saying, it's easy to kind of like judge it, I guess. But if you haven't lived that experience of going night to night, performance to performance on the road, and like, for instance, pulling out like I've done a recital here, and then the next night different pieces on a different recital, you know what I mean? And crazy. Then the next night a concerto. If you've never dealt with like the mental fuck up that is like in your brain, you know, then you can't really talk about it. But it's a special place to be. It's a scary place, but it'll just like exercise will physically harden you, it will emotionally and mentally harden you. And then you can you feel like you can kind of deal with anything. And I hadn't realized, let me kind of preface this. You know how like if you practice and then you take 2 days off and you come back to the piece, it's suddenly better?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so I know exactly what you're saying.
My mental like fortitude, it's the first time I thought about this, of all of the reps that I got for 2 years on the road and playing orchestra shows in my hometown and playing Bolero and Shasti 7 and like doing all the high pressure situations, those, it was like I was overtrained, overusing. And so my mental fortitude still felt shaky and all this. The pandemic, I didn't do any high pressure situations. I come back on stage and realize, like, I got better. I went back out there and I was like, I'm good. I feel good.
Yep.
I learned this piece in 2 weeks. I second guessed whether I knew it or not. And that was kind of weird because I've never learned a concerto so fast.
Yeah.
It was fine. So I was like, okay, the time off actually helped me mentally deconstruct and reconstruct everything. And now I feel like I'm going to be more stable from here on out.
Yeah. Cause I mean, you can only operate under, like, let's imagine the pandemic didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How long do you think you could have sustained that mindset or that kind of taxing activity? You know,
I didn't have that much more in me for sure. You look at it, and like you're saying, you talk about Cam Haynes and David Goggins and these super athletes. I mean, they're crazy. They're for sure crazy.
They're very rare.
Yeah, I feel. And could I have sustained their physical pace for me mentally? No. I don't think I could. I think I was, in my mind, I was at my peak point of mental exertion. And then I remember thinking in March, when right before the pandemic hit, I had a show the week before. And I had just come off of like the worst 4 or 5 months of my life musically, just butchering performances because I was too overbooked. And thinking to myself, you got to take a break, man. Like, or you're not going to make it through this. Like, I'm going to quit, you know? So funny enough is like the pandemic came at the right time. It just lasted too long and I wasn't quite ready. Like, I had my break planned out after those gigs, after the season. But, yeah, I couldn't have sustained it. So this was actually a really great reset. And now the experience of working on only one concerto, one piece, nothing else. Musically, it made me realize that, like, I'm going to stop overbooking myself in terms of new music. I'll still play a shitload of shows. That's fun. But to learn, like, I think I've premiered 11 pieces each season so far. That, you can't do it.
Bro.
And that's just solo pieces. You know what I mean?
Solo playing in itself is, it's unlike anything you'll ever do musically.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, it's so, it's such, I think it's just in a world of its own. Like, there's some things you can take from it to apply to ensemble playing, but like, like you being the driver and the passenger and the conductor and the whatever, like, it's just, there's that mental kind of pressure is doing that over and you said 11 new pieces in a season.
Yeah. I mean,
that's insane.
It got like the worst one, which was during that period I mentioned right before the pandemic. The worst thing that happened to me, like, this was a crazy one. I remember how this went. I was learning the Séjourné Concerto, which I played one movement of at that point. And like prior in a competition, I played like this soupy second movement, which is now, or first movement, which is now the second movement, the slow one. and I was playing the full piece, including the new added movement. So now it's like 30 minutes of marimba music, right? It's not particularly a hard piece. Just some moments, but I was learning that and learning a brand new concerto for wind ensemble at the time that I was going to premiere within like 2 weeks of each other. And also learning 4 hours of different, or 3 hours of different recital rep. One was a solo recital, one was my quartet recital, and another was a different solo recital. And so all that was happening at the same time. And so it was like October, and I was like rehearsing the Séjourné Concerto once a week with this group, driving to Cleveland. And then I did the dress rehearsal, I got on a plane, I flew to California, I played on the recital series with my quartet. The next morning, I flew back and played the Séjourné performance, and then I flew back to California to get on a plane and fly to Germany with my quartet, and then flew back and then came back and did duo recitals. I did a tour of duo recitals, and then I did more solo recitals. It was hilarious. And like, I fucking butchered the Séjourné performance. I mean, it was bad, and I have the recordings and they'll never see the light of day, but it was just purely embarrassing, you know. That was a bad time. And then the other one was like, I learned 4 new theater pieces in 7 days. And these were not easy. They were involving lav, like face mics, tech, projection. I did all of it in a week to debut on this recital series. And that show also just didn't go that well. Cause like, you know, how are you gonna, you can't do that.
Yeah.
It's so anyways, this is a,
it's gotta be balance, right?
There's gotta be balance. There's a power to going out on stage and feeling like you've mastered something, you know. There's power, like when you go out there and you know, like, I'm just gonna do what I do, and then you can actually enjoy it. But when you're on stage going shit, like,
yeah,
I kind of lived that for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, I don't know, where it was just I don't know, it was
just overbooking to a T, huh? I mean, like,
yeah, I'm better for it. I'm glad that I did it.
Oh yeah.
But
yeah.
Never again. So I think like my rule now is going to be, I think I could probably handle 2 pieces at once, like learning new things. But depending on how big these things are, I'll never do more than I can handle at this point, cuz I'm at the point in my career where my fees are increasing. You know, like the money I make is increasing. And so I don't feel like I need to take every gig and sacrifice my quality for those gigs. It's like, no, I can play a couple less shows and come out there and kick more ass than, you know, than I used to. So.
And you want to respect the piece in the right way. Not saying you disrespected.
No, I did, like, though. Saying, I did. Like,
well, I mean.
And I disrespected myself and the audience. Everybody involved was disrespected because of my lack of maturity and sort of selfishness by wanting to do more and more and more. But it also came from a place of fear that if I didn't do those things, my career wouldn't make it.
Yeah, it's all in good intentions, I think.
Yeah, but it's
like there is a certain,
yeah,
I think it's the, I don't think it's a bad sort of selfishness. I mean, you're trying to pursue a solo percussion career.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like, there, I mean, it's solo, like, there's it's nothing bad intentions behind that, I don't think, at the end of the day. So it's, but you know, that's a learning experience in itself. I couldn't imagine going from one place to the other side of the country to back and then to another country, and then it's like, you know, I'm tired just thinking about that. Like, I can't even imagine doing that and be like, oh, by the way, you got to play an hour of solo percussion music now. So like, yeah, and that's a learning experience, man.
It is. I mean, I think the pandemic kind of leveled a lot of things out in my head, or like, I think when I was really in it thick, like just trying to survive all that stuff, I was swinging kind of manically back and forth between things. Just like, I would be all the way off and just laying on the couch for a week, and then I would go to like being just freaking out for 3 months and trying to run around. And that was with performances, it was a lot of things. And one other thing that kind of what I wanted to talk about was like people in the industry or competitiveness. So when I was in school, and I don't know how you felt, but I would look around and I was feeling really competitive, not only within Eastman. I'll just talk about grad school when I kind of was knowing that I was going to go into this career. I felt really competitive at Eastman, and I would look around and like, they were still like really good friends of mine, but I was like, I want to do this better than them. You know, you always have that. And then there was also intra school competitive. It's like, I'd look at people at UNT or wherever else, and you could kind of tell that we were in weird silent competition with each other. It's just
always,
you know. And then there's this idea that a lot of people talk about, which is like, hey, there's enough room in the market for everybody. There's no reason to be competitive. Uplift everybody. So then I went to that mindset when I got out of school and realized people I was competing against, most of them, actually probably none of them, are trying to be solo percussionists. So like, I don't feel like I'm in competition anymore. So I'm happy. Then it makes it easier to support everybody and realize like, oh, what an immature mindset I had.
Right.
But what the pandemic made me realize is like, now there's gray area. And in the industry, you don't have to be friends with everybody. And again, this goes back to the not named conversation we had yesterday. But it's like there are shitty people, at least that I perceive to be shitty, in the industry, and that you do, and there are different for all of us. People we just don't get along with, and that's okay. And I'll be cordial to you or civil to you at least if I see you. But otherwise, like, because of certain things that have happened over the last months during the pandemic, personal attacks, talking shit and DMs and stuff, it's like, no, I usually kill people with kindness, but I've realized that if you're just going to be disrespectful, then fuck you, you know, because there's not enough time in the world to worry about what you think or whatever. So I think at the end of the day, I don't feel competitive against those people, but I just have realized that no, I don't have to just kumbaya everything, you know, because
well, we talk about balance, right?
Well, there's always shades of gray. They're always with everything.
Yeah. Well, you talk about, well, Tracy Wiggins had a post that actually led me to ask him to be on the podcast about percussive toxicity. And actually, we talked about it a little bit in your actual podcast episode a few months ago.
Yeah.
And where it's present in every institution, and it's present within the community, and that then bleeds into the social aspect of our community, right? And like, you got these cliques and you got these schools of thought, and then those people hang out and then talking shit on the other groups of people and their schools of thought. At the end of the day, we're just playing drums, right?
Right.
I mean, like, and it should be like that, but it's gotten to a point where it's not like that, and it's almost going to take generations to fix that of waves of students and professors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean,
it bleeds into everything is what I'm saying.
Like, artistic, judging someone's artistic choices is totally fine for me. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you don't like the way I played something, I don't care. Because like, I know in my head it's justified. And if it's wrong, I might correct it later. Or if someone who I trust tells me, like, hey, maybe you shouldn't do that. Like, I had someone come up to me at a concert, a guy that I really, really trust, happened to be in the same town that I was given a recital. And he comes up to me and he goes, don't you ever play that piece again. That's a piece of shit. And I was like, okay. And I never did.
Duly noted.
And never did. I'll never play that piece live again. He was like, no one wants to hear that for that long. And it was like, and I trust, and you know, we have a different kind of relationship. And also artistic choices, though, I'll never be upset about that.
Those are my favorite kinds of relationships, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Is when that brutal honesty.
Yeah.
You know?
But like, personal attacks, this is different. You know what I mean? And so, right. So when that kind of stuff starts embedding itself in our industry, and we're having a reckoning right now anyways, which I don't want to get into, right? But with all of the diversity issues that are going on, we're having a reckoning with that. And so that is causing a lot of social tension in the percussion community, as it probably should for a lot of cases. But yeah, I just realized, like, I don't even have to give you my time. Like, the first step to realizing that is, I don't have enough time to answer every comment, every email, every DM. That was hard enough for me to handle because I felt like I wanted to make myself available for anybody that needed something or wanted to tell me something. And I wanted to engage to the fullest extent. And then you don't have any time for yourself. So that's step number one. But then step number two is like, I'm not going to go back and forth and debate you on something in my DMs. If it's like an attack or like, no, I'm just not going to respond to you. I don't have time for your shit. So like, I think you start to really take care of yourself and your own well-being, and you just start to leave people and things behind because
it's not being selfish. I don't ever want to, you could call it selfish maybe, but it's a healthy selfishness maybe. I don't even know what the term is. And to me, like, I've had to learn that as well. I've had to learn where the balance is, right? Mm-hmm. Of like, mentors telling me, like, you don't want to do this that way because you're going to wind up like this.
Mm-hmm.
And they've seen it, and you trust it. It's the same thing. I have people that I trust that if they came up to me and said the same thing to you, I'd be like, yes, okay, I get it, right? And so I'm having to learn that in multiple ways right now in the pandemic. The pandemic teaches you stuff, but it doesn't teach you everything, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it teaches you stuff that you haven't thought about in a while, I guess. But there's going to be things like, I am glad we're talking about the fact that we're getting out of it.
Yeah.
But I think people are going to have to relearn some stuff. And we're going to have to make some adjustments again. You know what I mean? I don't think it's going to be gravy going back into real regular life again.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to all this stuff, right? And you know, it's kind of making an observation, right? A realistic observation and expectation, mm-hmm. where it's not going to be an easy transition. You're still going to have people being intense about what was supposed to be done during the pandemic, and like, you're going to have people that are so ready to get out of it that are going to try to jump in head first. And then you're going to have people that are also going to be still being activists for issues that were brought up during it as well. So it's just going to be this whirlwind, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and every facet of the world, business, art, you know, everything. So it's just my thoughts on that, where I don't think there should be a realistic expectation.
Well, when we start seeing people again face to face, I mean, and let me be clear too, not when I say like personal attacks or people like messaging me being shitty, it's like, yeah, some of that had to relate to some things that have happened recently on the side of you know, issues of diversity and things like that, that I've been proxied basically and associated with. But that's a totally different set of topics. There's also just stuff like, I make a post on Facebook in the midst of the pandemic, and I said two words in an order that someone didn't like, and like, they're trying to dunk on me and like tell me I'm a piece of shit. It's like, I don't have time for this, you know? And I don't want my, like, what I'm saying to you right now and what people are listening to this, I don't want them to be like, wow, Cameron sounds like an asshole. Like, what an aggressive sounding dude. No, it's like, the pandemic has kind of exposed really good things and also really bad things. There's a lot of time for people to just get online and just attack people, because we're living our lives online. Bored. But when we get back together in person, we see each other at PASIC, and you walk by somebody that you, are you going to wave and be cordial? It's like, you know, when you get face to face again, we're all going to have to rehumanize each other, because we've just been avatars online for a year. I think that's going to be huge.
Been Twitter eggs and you know, it's man, that's gonna be, I think this might be the weirdest PASIC in history.
Oh yeah.
And I want to do an offstage series at PASIC. I think that'd be cool.
You got to do it, man. I mean,
I'm gonna get a hotel room and just set everything up and have a bunch of podcasts,
dude. Split a room. I'm telling you, so a lot of some of these PASICs, I've split rooms with people. Some of them I've gotten my own room. It's beautiful to have your own room at PASIC, when you can like get away from the madness and then not have to like deal with somebody snoring or something.
Yeah.
But it's friggin' expensive, dude.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, they're upcharging. I can only imagine what a hotel costs right now since the NCAA tournament's there.
Oh yeah.
In Indy. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Like,
it's like $206 a night, if I remember, for PASIC. So if you do all four nights, you know, you're spending over $800 on a room by yourself. So,
have they announced PASIC yet?
I don't think officially, because I think they're still going to try to deal with artist applications. But see, I got bumped a year, so I'm on this upcoming PASIC. But they're also going to, I'm doing a solo show, like a showcase concert. So I don't know what I'm going to do yet, because I had it planned out, and now I'm like, well, there are issues of representation in my program too that I hadn't thought about. So I'm going to have to kind of figure out what exactly I want to play now. I was going to do all my own commissions, but all the pieces that I've commissioned from females or people of color, they don't work in this program. Mm. So I'm kind of at a conundrum where I'm like, I don't have the money to commission another piece. I could possibly run a commission, but I don't know if it'll be done in time for me to learn it. And I wanted it to be a concert of all my own commissioned music. So I'm a little bit, my original vision for the concert's probably going to have to change. you know, but it kind of is what it is. I hadn't thought about that before, but I realized that all those pieces that I have commissioned from, you know, underrepresented groups are like theatrical, or they're not with electronics. They don't quite work with the setup. So
yeah,
it sucks.
Well, maybe if we split a room, I'll be your roadie too. I'll help you get set up for that.
Dude, I gotta bring a box truck. So like this, I'll probably ask the Malitech booth for everything. And because these setups, there's not going to be time to move them on stage. So I'm hoping I've requested a humongous stage. I'm like, I need a big stage or else this is not going to happen. And it's not because I want to play in that big room. I'm not going to be able to sell out that room or, you know, fill the room up. I'd rather see less empty seats in a medium sized room, but I'm just curious because I can't move setups on stage and re-mic between my pieces. And I want to play continuously for 45 to 50 minutes. So I'm probably going to need at least two marimbas and at least two vibraphones on stage, you know, and a shitload of other stuff. So I'm going to bring all my stuff from here and the Malitech booth, I hope.
I could fly to Columbus and then,
I mean,
like ride with you over there. Wait, how long of a drive is that?
It's like 2.5. It's not bad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But dude, I mean, honestly, regardless of that, setting up a podcast in the hotel room, when I did it, it was goofy because like the chair, like I would bring you good chairs to use, you know, because like when I did it, I had a really tall chair and a really small, and then people sitting on the bed, it was like, it was ridiculous, man. And I have
like, you're sitting on the floor.
I have some ridiculous shit from that where like Ksenia, Komlinovich, Alexander Espere, Josh Jones, and Kai Strobel all came to my hotel room and we were tanked. And I said, guys, this will never see the light of day, but I'm going to turn the cameras and mics on and let's just have a good. So like, I still have this episode like on my hard drive that like, I've never watched it since then. Like one day I'm going to turn that on and watch that because it got ridiculous.
you definitely should. Cause, it's kind of like our episode yesterday. It's never going to see the light of day.
Yeah.
We weren't trash or anything, but we were definitely going off.
Yeah.
So it's looks like PASIC's gonna be in person, so
yeah. I mean,
saying Indianapolis,
that's the plan, you know.
All right, well, I mean, it's this could be fun. I've always wanted to do that. I don't want to, like, first of all, I can't afford a booth PAS. If I did a booth and just like pull people off the exhibit floor and was like, hey, come talk for a sec, I thought that'd be funny, but I'm not like Steven Crowder.
Yeah, I mean, It was actually a pain in the ass to do it, like because of just everything going on. And then I started realizing, like, I don't want to go up and do a podcast. I want to go like hang out with my friends and drink booze, you know, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So it is tough. I think like if you go into it and already have things sort of
planned out,
my music just started playing in my AirPods. Hang on a second.
Oh, okay.
I just hit some butt. Drake, Passion Fruit by Drake just started playing in my earbuds.
Oh my god. Okay. I could go on a rant about that song. It's so underrated.
Oh yeah.
It's so underrated. It is one of the most underrated Drake songs of all time, and it does not get the recognition it deserves. I'm just saying that one and Come Through off the Nothing Was the Same album.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, dude, we can wrap this up or I can go pee.
Yeah.
It's up to you.
Let's go and wrap it. We're at hour 15. And
yeah, we did good.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a good one. We don't have to throw this one out the back window.
This one worked, man. I just got a little hyper-aggressive at one point. We're all good.
No, we dialed it back. We are at least hyper-aware now.
There you go.
Here's the thing, though, everybody listening. We know that we could talk for hours. And so if it feels like it's an abrupt ending, it's because we know we could go on for hours.
That's
so
very true.
Offstage number one. I think it went well. It was a lot of fun. It always is.
It is fun, man. We got to record the intro now.
Got to record the intro. And you can follow me at Heartwell Drums. Follow Cam at Sea Leech Music, right?
Yes. And Drums and Drams. Cool. Heyo.
He's monetized now, and we're going to help grow his channel as much as we can. on YouTube, and look out for his Patreon announcement. I'm thinking about doing one too. We'll see.
And, you should, man.
Yeah, I think we can talk about that. Yeah. So you know where to find us: all major platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, Apple Podcasts, rather. And if you're interested, just like the monthly ad was talking about, that support link down in the description below. For just like $1 a month, you can help grow the podcast. So that's it for this one.